You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Let's ride!
You know, I was telling Gypsy when the good evening, everybody. It's quite frankly 7:02 p.m. on the East Coast. Telling Gypsy, Anthony, Mike, and Gypsy are just chilling out over here. Can't wait for our guest tonight. We're going to be giving him a call at 7:15. Rabbi Mark Borowitz. I can't wait to get this story. I'm so interested in his story. This guy was a mobster, a gangster, an addict. Had a real, real nasty past, and he turned it all around, and he became a rabbi, and now he's on to his second book that's coming out. Gonna talk about that. And just like Dr. Cali Estes from last week, he's big in alternative ways of really approaching addiction and fighting addiction, and I can't wait to ask what his opinions on the war on drugs are and all that stuff, but more importantly, I just want to hear about this guy's story. Such a great thing. Let's read the bio a little bit. But I was telling Gypsy before that I every night that I do the show, that the, you know, it's the Star Wars theme or whatever theme it is, crashes into the actual disclaimer and all that stuff. I'm always afraid that something's going to freeze up and the disclaimer's not going to come up. It's a big flop. It's just like a fart. So I gotta do it one night just to... I've got to actually screw up on purpose one night to get it out of my system.
You should. You should. It's all about facing the fear. What's the worst that can happen, right?
I don't know.
You have to restart. That's all.
That's true. That is true.
Starting again.
There's a couple of times that I thought that I had to... that I wasn't going to get the intro music that flows in
right.
time. Mm-hmm. That's worse to me than anything else. I can't stand that initial drop off and that nothingness. It's just like a nothingness and a voice. I hate that.
You know, it's funny. It's different engineering here than the other studio because everything was on the left side. So sometimes like certain drops with the audio and the video trying to match it up. It's like, ah. Get caught up sometimes.
Well, not only that, the other studio, it sucks that we had such cheap audio, cheap microphones at the other studio, because aside from the cheaper microphones, we got better sound out of the room because of the drop ceiling and how you know, cozy the room was.
Absolutely.
We got tall ceilings up here. That's another reason why I believe that music beds underneath my show is necessary. Because I can't stand that, oh, he's in a big room type of sound.
Right, right. No, totally.
So, but in either case, let's read up on Rabbi Borowitz.
This is going to be good tonight.
It's going to be great.
I'm excited. Really.
Here's
excited.
A little bit of his bio. Let's see here. Officially ordained in 2000 at the University of Judaism with a master's in rabbinic literature, Rabbi Mark Borowitz combined his knowledge of Torah and street smarts to shape his calling, helping recovering addicts find their way in the world. Spiritual leader, author, head rabbi, CEO, and overall anomaly, he's been able to reach both the addict and the congregant, and destigmatize this life-threatening disease, the disease being addiction. So I want to know about like what kind of crews he ran with.
Yeah.
I want to know about all of the stuff, and I want to know about that breaking point. What was the wake up?
Yeah, when did he hit his bottom?
Yeah,
what were the players around him doing? How did it come to that? Like the moments leading up to that. What was that like? That would be interesting to know.
Absolutely, very, very interested in that. But let me see here. That's good enough for here. Oh, listen to this. In 2004, Rabbi Mark was one of the seven people invited to the roundtable discussion with President George W. Bush about faith and recovery. The rabbi was also mentioned in President Bush's speech before the first conference on faith-based initiatives. He had been the featured speaker in many seminars discussing spirituality and recovery, including CASA at CASA at Columbia University and Spirituality Day at Northwestern University. So, but here's the thing. I believe this was part. I have to go back to the part of the bio that I was checking out here, because I believe the big thing here was that he's helping people through the Torah.
Okay.
And Judaism, even if people aren't Jews.
I see. So he's using the principles and the values.
Yeah, so I want to know how he took Judaism and made it interfaith.
Right.
Let me write down that phrasing.
Write it down. It's nothing worse than forgetting a great idea.
How did you?
How did you do it? How did you do it?
Judaism.
What's up to everyone in the chat? How's everyone doing tonight? Glad you guys could join us on ZenLive.tv, and Frank is back.
Yeah. Yes, welcome everybody. Let's see, we got a good, nice crowd here tonight.
Awesome.
Also, when we get off the air with Rabbi Mark, we're going to talk about David Seaman's work, and especially everything that he had happened to him over the last couple of days with Huffington Post taking down his article and terminating him as an author there,
right.
A writer there. And I appeared on his podcast today to talk about more of these. That's too loud. More of these leaks, and that show media collusion, because the censoring of press and all that stuff, that's very, very concerning.
Right.
And the thing was that his Huffington Post article was one questioning, actually looking into whether or not it was a viable question to even pose about Hillary Clinton's health because of that Paul Joseph Watson video that put out that outlined testimony from and writings from doctors who know what kind of injury she had and the outcome, seizures, possible seizure that would happen, seizure-like behavior, her relationship with her Secret Service, her inability to do things for long periods of time and needing all of this rest. And it just seems like, you know, there were some legitimate questions that I think that need to be actually backed off of, because sooner or later it's going to start looking like everybody's picking on a poor old woman. And it's actually not going to look very fanciful.
Yeah.
But still, there are questions that should be asked because they all have credence. But we just know how these things are spun. Even the inquiry of something is spun in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So because he looked into that and it became the top three the article of the day on Huffington Post, terminated everything and wiped it all under the rug.
Wow.
And he was actually on Alex Jones' show yesterday.
Okay.
And he's been doing media, and I was on his broadcast today to talk about this stuff, because this is clear media collusion, and it goes hand in hand with everything we found in those DNC leaks that pretty much showed everybody that the Democrat voter has been disenfranchised.
Yeah.
Whether they wanted Hillary or not, they were only going to ever get Hillary. And then the other thing is that every last network out there is doing everything they can to make sure that Hillary Clinton is in office. And when you're talking about suppression of free press because of the fourth estate that's supposed to be completely separate, and keeping the third, first, and second estate in check with truthful, unbiased journalism,
it's a recipe for disaster.
It is.
It really is.
It's a constitutional crisis, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a meltdown. It really is a governmental meltdown, and it's playing out in front of people. I was listening to Lewis Black. He was on MSNBC, and he had actually on a skit on The Daily Show wanted Trump to be president. He had a sign that said Trump 2012. It's a very funny clip and very future telling. And so MSNBC, Morning Joe, whatever, was interviewing him. And they were like, so what do you think? And he, you know, went on one of his rants where he was yelling. He was like, you can't even satire life anymore, because it is satire. Mm. It is so far gone. We've become fucking TV.
Yeah, it's outrageous, but not only that. Whereas you can't, we became the satire we used to dip into, but then return to reality.
Right, right.
Okay, so we became this frozen state of satire. But the problem with that is that whenever somebody tries to break out of the insanity and try to speak straight now, because of the political correctness that came with the satire that we used to joke about hypersensitive people.
Right, that's you know? True.
We used to joke about them. Now we can't. Now we're in it. We're in the joke. Okay, so now because we're with these hypersensitive people constantly, and the political correctness is getting so bad, we're now prevented from even having sane conversations anymore.
Right. You can't be on the level with people.
That's the last joke. I think that's the last phase of the joke there, is that the joke protects itself with the same type of sensitivity it used to make fun of. Holy shit, dude.
Boom!
We just blew something loose.
Sorry.
Something just got blown loose right now.
I'm telling you, because life is a joke. Life is a joke. Like, this is a joke. It's a game. That's it. This is the step into the Matrix. We're walking into the fucking thing.
I just looked down to make sure that I recorded the first the first 12 minutes of the show.
Effing God.
Because there's a couple of highlights that need to be made out of everything that just went down.
I think so. That was good.
Oh my God. And that's what's happening in the second half of the show. We just did the second half of the show in 12 minutes. See, we waste too much time. We waste so much time. Oh, Christ. In either case, if this is your first night watching, everybody, welcome to the show. Welcome to ZenLive.tv. My name is Frank. This is Quite Frankly. This is Gypsy. Gypsy's the host of Hangover Takeover on Monday nights. He's a partner here, and he is program director. You can get Gypsy on at gypsy@zenlive.tv.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can reach out to me, frank@zenlive.tv, if you want to contribute at all to the network as a writer, anything. We don't really have any paid positions right now, but if we make a... You know, we just want, if anybody wants
just
to jump
work
on
with
us,
it's a good time.
Work with us. We just want to start banding together for a very important time.
There's
of
a bigger
action.
Cause.
Bigger
much,
cause.
Much bigger cause.
And once we figure out how to get paid, there'll definitely
You'll
be something.
Right there with us.
You'll be in on the ground floor.
You're right there with us.
Oh, God. Well, in either case, hello, Gadget Doc, Moonlit Matt, Nikki, Lester, Mad Lark, ZZZ 1987, and a bunch of people who are watching but not in the chat room, please join us.
Yeah. Sign into Ustream, create your account. We'd love to talk to you. And of course, they could Skype in and call in.
Yes.
At some point.
Yes, and we're going to call Rabbi Mark right now.
All right.
Here we go. Hello, hello, Rabbi Mark.
Hello. Yes.
Mr. Mark Borowitz.
It's me. How are you?
Very nice to have you on the show. I have to say, first of all, my name is Frank, and I'm joined here by my good friend and associate and co-host of the evening, Gypsy, and Mike, and a couple of people who are watching, but we're very, very happy to have you on the show.
It is my honor to be on the show.
Now, Rabbi, your story is one of such intrigue, and it's like... something that you really just hear stories about, like urban legends, or it's something that shows up on the silver screen. And I think that, you know, and I definitely want to talk about your book, and we definitely want to talk about your cause, because I think it goes hand in hand with the conversation we had last week with our other guest that was involved with helping to rehabilitate people and also lay some commentary down on the drug war itself, which I think that you are going to have some very, very keen insight on. But let's, starting from the beginning... what can you say, what kind of circles did you roll with? Can you tell us how you actually got into the type of lifestyle that you eventually needed to pull yourself out of?
Wow. As I recount in my book, The Holy Thief, published, it's now 13 years, it's crazy. Mm. But what happened was, I was a kid we were poor, and when my father was alive, he should rest in peace, we didn't know we were poor. After he died, everything changed, and our barber was a fence for the local mafia, and I went to him, and I said, I need to do something to help Mom. Mm. my mother, because she was making $2 an hour back in 1966, and our mortgage, that was gross, and our mortgage was $150 a month. Wow. And there was
Are you a New Yorker?
No, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio.
My papa's from Cleveland.
So he said, here, take this stuff and sell what you know, I'll give it to you on consignment. Sell what you can. Here's what the cost is. And you take the rest. You make the rest. And whatever you don't sell, bring back to me. And that started a life for me. It started a life of hustling. It started a life where, you know, I'd get in the back of the car and pick up number slips. Because as a kid, if I got caught, nothing would happen to me. And I became enamored with my self-worth being tied up to my net worth. If I had money, I was something. If I didn't have money, I was nothing. Mm. And I was, you know,
it's an addiction. I mean,
they all knew me and everything. And so I just kept, you know, doing more hustles and scams and things like that with different people in the in the underworld, as we used to call it then.
Well, from there, obviously this probably escalates in many different ways. Let's go to the height of your living within those circles. Where were you? What were you dealing with right before you had a reality check? Like, what were you dealing in gambling? Was it prostitution? You know, what kind of rings were you running?
No, I was always in. Scams and cons, and I did a lot of check kiting and forgeries. Wow. Check forgeries, and for a while I was doing it with people, and then I was just doing it on my own, and I just kept getting more and more desperate, and so.
And what was that breaking point? So first of all, were you a religious man prior to your turnaround?
Well, I was religious in that I went to, as a teenager, I went to Hebrew. As a kid, I went to Hebrew school. I had a bar mitzvah. I went every day to services to say the prayer for the dead for my father, the cottage prayer it's called in Hebrew. And I was president of my youth group when I was 16. What happened? What happened was I was walking across the street. I was in the Sanford. I moved out to California. The truth is that somebody had wanted to take a contract out on me. And the local mafia people said, no way. And then they looked at me and they said, you're getting really sloppy. It's time for you to leave town.
Wow.
So I did. And I came out to California, to Los Angeles, because my oldest brother lived out here. And then I got back into the automobile business. So even when I had a legitimate job, it was a little shady, you know, selling used cars and everything.
Yeah.
And I was still hustling and conning. So then I turned my hustle I put my expertise or my hustle for cars together with my criminality. I started wholesaling cars and buying them on bad checks and then selling them and getting the cash. So what happened was I was walking across the street. I'd been on the run, and a car, a white Ford Fairmount, turned the corner. And I didn't even look up. I was reading the old Herald Examiner because I was going to bet a 10-team football parlay. I was a pretty good handicapper in those days. And a guy stopped the car, called out my name. I looked up. The man's name was Detective Jim Bashira. And he had arrested me. This was December of 1986. He had arrested me in January of 1981.
Well, so the same cop came back.
We're talking about really 6 years. He had seen a wanted poster on me from Santa Barbara County, which is north of Los Angeles. And a month before, and as he turned the corner, all of this came together for him in this, split second it takes to turn a corner. And I'm arrested.
Jeez.
So he's got me at the substation, and I call my first wife and I say to her, come pick up this money because I had a couple grand on me. And she said, what bail bondsman do you want me to call? And these words came out of my mouth almost 30 years ago. I said, don't call anyone. The man upstairs is trying to tell me something, and I have to sit here till I can figure it out.
Wow. That
I have no idea where those words came from.
And it just spilled out of you, and just like that, that is the most definitive turnaround in your life, you can say confidently.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's really something else.
My brother's been a rabbi since 1975, so I called him and I said, send me a Bible and a prayer book.
Wow.
And I started to study and I started to immerse myself in everything and in text, you know, in holy scriptures and in real prayer.
So now you had drug and substance abuse problems as well?
No, I had alcohol problems.
Okay, and was that...
You could say it was a problem. I drank about a gallon or so a day of whiskey.
Jeez.
I don't drink a gallon of anything a day.
And you have a fully functional liver right now?
Yeah, it's not fair. Life is not fair, thank God.
Jeez, okay. Well, that is something. Now, was that the day that you stopped drinking as well?
Oh, yeah. When you're in jail, they don't give you a lot of drink.
And but even when you went out, you didn't go.
No, when I got out, I had three different drinks in 1988. I'm sober since December 17th of 1988. I'd gone home. I was on a work furlough, and I went to my first wife's house, and I had a screwdriver. It didn't taste right. I thought the tomato juice was bad. Then I had a straight vodka, and that tasted bad. I said, okay, so vodka's not my drink anymore. And then I had a whiskey, a Crown Royal, and that was wrong. And I realized that booze quit me. I didn't quit booze.
Yeah.
So I was struck sober, and I'm blessed, you know, and I've lived honoring the blessing of not have to do crime and not have to drink. And not have to be if you'll excuse the expression.
Well, let me ask you.
Asshole and a monster. I was a terrorist to anybody and everybody around me. And I think this is something that a lot of recovering people don't take seriously. And a lot of other, and people who are, who are dealing with addicts don't realize we're terrorists. We terrorize everybody around us, especially our family.
Well,
my daughter didn't have a father who was really present for six of the first 8.5 years of her life.
In your bio, you talk a lot about the hundreds of thousands of drug deaths there are every year, and how only one in five people seek help. Well, what are you doing now? You had your turnaround. You devoted yourself to study. You became a rabbi. And now, what are you doing to make it easier for people who need to get help, especially with the cost of treatment and everything out there? How are you making it so that to help improve that one in five number?
Well, my second wife and my current wife, Harriet Rosetto, founded a program called Beit Shuvah, which means house of return in Hebrew. And she has, and I have for the last almost 28 years now, made sure that nobody was ever denied treatment because they didn't have money. Mm-hmm. We have never turned anyone away because they didn't have money.
So is it funded through donations, or is it just the labor of the hosts?
Donations. Some people pay. You know, I mean, some people can afford it, so they pay. But we if you don't have money, that doesn't put you at the bottom of the list.
That's amazing.
We take people. Wow. We take people based on the need and whether or not we can help them. And we have a long-term program. Our primary care program is 4 to 6 months. Because the ridiculous thing, guys, is if you've got a problem where you have to go to rehab, 30 days of rehab where they're giving you drugs to get you off the other drugs, and then all of a sudden tell you, oh, okay, you're fine now after 28 days. It's stupid. And now, of course, when your insurance runs out, you're cured. I mean, it's become a business. We keep seeing every human being as a holy soul. Every person matters. Everybody is an individual. So while we have a program that's, you know, very large and extensive, we also make individual, we individualize it for everybody so that they know that they matter. And you know what? What's going to work for you isn't exactly a carbon copy. Is not going to work for the person next to you because you're not carbon copies. We're all unique individuals. Mm-hmm. We have a facility that houses 130 people. 130 plus people. Mm-hmm. We have two other facilities that for independent transitional housing that house another 30. So we always have 160 people that we're caring for. We have a career center. We help people get jobs and careers.
And do you have a website that people can go check out and find out more information about what you guys do and where you're located?
Yeah. Yes, it's www.BEIT.org.
I'm sure that you've gotten, you've had to say that so many times with all
yeah.
of, yep, there you go.
Rabbi, I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to know because your passion, your conviction towards not only your own sobriety, but others. Do you think the intensity that you put into, you know, the lifestyle that you were once in, you are now basically mirroring that energy, but putting it in a positive form? Because the way you're describing the type of and level of care you're giving these people, I wish there was a way we could do this for everyone, because he's exactly right. I mean, as corny and cliched as it sounds, we're all freaking snowflakes over here.
Yeah, well, you know, when you talk about the mix of body and mind, yeah, right. Everybody's different.
Right, so and then you have spirit on top of it. Mm. Because we incorporate Judaism, the 12 Steps of the Anonymous Program, psychotherapy, mind-body, trauma, creative arts, psychiatry. We have SERP therapy. We have acupuncture. We have meditation. Hey, you name it.
Rabbi,
doing it.
Let me ask you something else.
Can I answer your other question?
Sure, go ahead, please.
Here's the thing. If I'm not all in my life, then I'm not really living.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful question you asked, you see, because I have to put the same intensity that I put into being a criminal and a drunk. Mm-hmm. I have to put that same intensity into my life so that I remember that I'm alive. Mm-hmm. I'm alive. And being alive, I have to remember that, as Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel says, my destiny is to aid and to serve. Mm. So, like Father Greg Boyle of Homeboy Industry says, we have to erase the margins. We are all kinfolk. It doesn't matter Jew, Gentile, Muslim. Okay, it doesn't matter black, white, brown, yellow, whatever. When I look at you, if I don't see me and I don't see a reflection of the divine, I'm blind. It's my eye disease. There's nothing wrong with you.
Let me ask you this. Now, wow. We've gotten the impression that you, even though you work through Judaism, and that is the religion that has been such a big part of your life and your recovery, but you say that even if you're not a Jew, this is something that you are able to experience through. How do you go about making a monotheistic religion so interfaith for other people?
Well, because it's the spiritual principles. So the Dalai Lama one time, many years ago, was in Sun Valley, Idaho, and he had a one-day conference for religious leaders, and I was privileged to be there. And he was with Karen Armstrong, and he made this statement: at the core of every spiritual discipline is justice, compassion, kindness, love, and truth. Mm. And when you speak truth to somebody, and you do it with love. Now, my love is loud and boisterous and in your face. But everybody that comes into my orbit knows that I am deeply and intensely invested in them living well. So we have helped people go back to their own faiths after they had left it. One man told people, he says, I'm a Korean Christian who came to a Jewish rehab to find my faith and be able to go back to my community.
That's unbelievable. That's, and you know something, it's happened to me more and more that I'm starting to actually celebrate. I mean, I'm not taking out the balloons or anything like that, but I'm starting to really appreciate stories and just happenings of faith, rebirth and faith.
Yeah.
I like seeing an inspired, driven faith, a person who's just welling over with faith. Everybody knows a bad apple when they see a bad apple. Everybody knows when somebody's doing something for ulterior motives and they're not living a very kind life. But aside from that, we're seeing so much more people cower away from these types of experiences these days, I feel like they want nothing to do with it because they don't want to be just like seen around it.
Right, absolutely.
Do you feel like there's a growing almost like embarrassment of religion in the world, the country? What of your observations of outside, Rabbi?
Well, here's what's happened. Okay, there's a lot of charlatans out there, and when you see what supposed faith leaders are doing, you have to run away from it. Faith, what's so important about faith, one of the things, is that I have to be accountable to something greater than myself. I just got back from a Danube River cruise with my wife. And we were in Budapest. And I don't know if you know this, but one of the memorials in Budapest are shoes cemented into the bank of the Danube, because the Hungarians and the Nazis marched Jews down to the riverbank, had them take off their shoes because they wanted the leather, and then shot them in the back of the head, and they fell into the Danube. When you think about the great culture of Vienna, of Prague, of Budapest, and all of the countries, and you see that that culture also created and fostered hatred for no other reason than a religion, you have to run away from faith. But real faith is, I sit with Father Boyle, I sit with another friend of mine, Pastor Mark Whitlock from CORE AME Church in Irvine, and the three of us sit and we're talking and we're together and we're connected and everybody sees the love and the respect and the faith and you can feel that energy. So you see, people are running away from faith because they feel that it's bullshit. And because of the way faith leaders have practiced it and have talked about it, should I be involved in politics? Yes. To say that we have to take care of the widow, the orphan, the poor, and the stranger, that we have to treat each other as kinfolk. But it's not about whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, and it's not about conservative or liberal. It's about what's right for the human race, and how do we honor the dignity the infinite dignity and the infinite worth of every human being. Rabbi Heschel said, prejudice is an eye disease, E-Y-E. It's my eyesight that's bad. So faith tells us to take the cataracts off of our eyes, to circumcise the foreskin of our hearts, and to know that in order to be human, you have to break, you have to be broken so that you can let love in and send love out. Now, that kind of faith, I get 350 to 400 people every Friday night for our Friday night services for this kind of faith. And we have a band and we rock and roll and we do all this stuff. But the whole thing is spirit, is how am I connecting to me, to others, to my soul, to the souls of others? And how am I coming together as a community to stand for what is right in the world?
Well, I gotta say, I mean, it goes without saying that your passion just blasts through the other end of the phone, and I want to go hang out with you, dude. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I think that is the most inspirational thing that's ever been said on the show.
You know? I have to say this. What I'm picking up from what Rabbi Mark is talking about is that faith is fellowship. It's the fellowship. It's being with your friends and family and your community. And by having faith in one another, that is when we can ascend to the next level. And only then, when we realize that we are all one race, and that's the only way that it
can. Yes, and we're connected, okay? So yeah. It's fellowship with deep connection. See, when you think about booze, on a lot of bottles of booze, you'll see distilled spirits. Mm-hmm. When you listen to the language of addiction, okay, drug addiction, I'm going to my connection to get a fix, to get well.
Right. It's in the language.
Why do I need to get well from a fix when I can get well by being and hanging out with you guys? I'm so invigorated by this conversation. I mean, I'm ready to jump out of my skin.
It's likewise.
It's great because I'll tell you something. We got people watching. There was going to be much more people that listen afterward when the podcast is up. And these types of public displays and these dialogues, I think they're so important because, I mean, I'll tell you, a lot of people would want to stay away from having rabbis or priests or anything like that on a show these days, and without, because like we said before, there's that stigma, there's a little bit of embarrassment, there's a little bit of a stiff undertone of, oh my God, like you guys aren't human once you find your calling and it brings you into a religious world. It's almost like you guys cease to be human or something, and it's the opposite. I've had some of the best conversations ever with people of faith.
Absolutely.
You know, you still walk away the same person, but you know what? Maybe in the least bit, you're just a little bit more. You take the guard down a little bit more.
It's the enlightenment. It's the understanding. That's what I say.
Really.
See, here's the deal. I have to be transparent. Addiction is a hiding. It's an escape. And by the way, we can talk about drug addiction, but I think you can figure out there's a lot of hiding in our country. A lot of people who think that their stuff doesn't stink, who are still hiding. We hide behind gated communities. We hide behind gates. We hide behind walls. We hide behind money. We hide behind all these things. Faith and recovery is about transparency. So I'll tell you who I am. You can see all of my foibles because I'm certainly not perfect. And you know what? I would rather have you see my foibles. In fact, I'll tell you, I'm more interested in you seeing my flaws than I am of hiding them from you, because hiding them, it gets me, takes me down a terrible path, and then it takes you down a terrible path.
Well, the book is called Finding Recovery and Yourself in Torah by Rabbi Mark Borowitz, and he, thank you so much for this call tonight, Rabbi. I'd actually love to have you on more often.
Can I would love to anytime you want. Can I just add one thing about
please.
What's going on with in today's world
please,
with,
please.
With addiction?
Yes.
Addiction has become a big business. People are using the insurance companies and the Affordable Care Act to make money, not to save lives. Big Pharma and even the government is talking about Suboxone and keeping people loaded. And they are loaded on Suboxone. You can even ask Dr. Drew Pinsky. And the whole thing is everybody is afraid to do what it takes and be in the trenches to help people live an abstinent, happy, joyous, free life. Because you see, if I can, just like with the methadone, if I can keep you a little bit off, then I can control you. Mm-hmm. Recovery, which our entire country needs, especially our politicians, recovery is being real. Just like you guys are talking real with me and I'm talking real with you. This is recovery. And we have to make sure that our government doesn't do the same thing with Suboxone that they did with methadone. And that is create a system that just keeps perpetuating itself because the bureaucrats and the big farm want to make money.
Well, then let me ask you one more question because I think this goes hand in hand. As far as the war on drugs goes, we were talking about the real downside and actually the real harm that's caused within this war of drugs and how it's ruining all of the all the same lives it was intended to try to help. What do you think that the current laws on the books regarding substances and legalization and decriminalization, what do you think is really needed on a policy level? Do you think that
Treatment is what's needed. Look, somebody using dope, they're not a criminal. Now, it's true, if they keep using, they will do criminal acts, okay? I mean, I know that. But we do a whole lot of alternative sentencing here as well, okay, where we go to the courts and advocate for people because treatment is going to do better than prison. So I don't know that we should legalize because I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid of what happens if we legalize drugs because I think we'll lose a generation. That's my personal belief. I do know that we have to get out of locking people up because they use drugs.
So decriminalize. 30,
40 years for crack cocaine is stupid. I mean, that's just dumb.
Well, thank you so much for that. And like I said before, we have to have you on because I think that you're very, very important and you have a great energy. And I think that yours is a voice that I would like to hear more interpretation of the reality around us from, especially as the big plot that is Earth 2016 continues to develop before our eyes. I'd love to just keep getting your opinion on things.
Anytime you want, I'm available. I love this conversation. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
I'm so honored to hang out with you.
No doubt. And I'll send you some highlights of all this. We've been putting your book up on the screen. There it is again, Finding Recovery in Yourself in Torah, Rabbi Mark Borowitz. And thank you so much, sir, for coming on with us.
Thank you. God bless.
All right. Take care.
Bye now.
Damn it.
I did it again.
It always comes down to that last... Right. Later. I'm just going to let everybody say their own thing from now on and just shut my mouth.
Let them hang up first, Frank.
Oh, God, dude, okay.
You know what my last thought was as he was winding down? I was thinking of Batman. I was thinking of Jack Nicholson. He was like, this town needs an enema.
This town needs an enema. Hey, you know what we'll go on break with? Another movie clip. I got two clips from Charlie Wilson's War.
Oh, of course.
Gotta
play them.
Right now, we're gonna play Gust's big meltdown at the CIA.
Hey, Frank.
Yes.
Are you recording the show?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
It's still recording. Thank God.
This is such a great show.
This is the introduction of Philip Seymour Hoffman's character in whatchamacallit.
Charlie Wilson's
War. Watched it twice in the last couple of days. It's just been on. It's been amazing.
Have you seen the trailers that I sent you?
Okay.
We'll talk about
it. I know
it
was difficult for you to come in here.
I know. Hold on.
That's not the kind of...
I just fucking did that by accident. Be right back, everybody. Hold on a second. take this off.
Whee!
Enjoy.
Okay. I know it was difficult for you to come in here hat in hand. That's not the kind of upbringing, I guess is the word I'm looking for. It's not the kind of man you are. I understand that. I'm not looking to humiliate you or exact a price in any way, so why don't you just apologize? We'll call it water under the dam and we'll go about our business.
Excuse me, what the fuck?
What?
What the fuck are you talking about?
Claire George said you were coming in here to apologize.
No, I'm supposed to come in here so you could apologize to me.
According to whom?
Claire George.
You told me to go fuck myself. I'm supposed to apologize to you?
Also, water goes over a dam and under a bridge, you poncy schoolboy.
Clearly, there's been a miscommunication between Claire George and somebody.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Does this look all right?
It's fine. Thank
you. I can sand it down a little.
I don't know. No fucking idea who this guy is.
He is here to fix the glass that you broke the last time you were here. Could you just excuse us for a second?
Yes.
Tell me to go fuck myself and I'm supposed to apologize? Yeah. You break my window. I'm supposed
to apologize? The Helsinki job was mine.
The Helsinki job was not yours. If it was yours, you'd be in Helsinki.
Alan Wolf stood in the
office.
Alan
Wolf is no longer the director.
It was on the
Alan
books.
Wolf is no longer the director of European operations. He does not make those appointments, I do.
Promises were made.
Not by me.
I've been with the company for 24 years. I was posted in Greece for 15. Papandreou wins that election if I don't help the junta take him prisoner. I've advised and armed the Hellenic army. I've neutralized champions of communism. I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish, which should come in handy here in Virginia, and I'm never ever sick at sea. So I want to know why I'm not going to be your Helsinki station chief.
Your course.
Excuse me.
For Helsinki, I need someone with diplomatic skills. You don't have them.
Is that right?
That is right, and I don't know why the hell I didn't fire you when you broke my fucking window.
Oh, yes, sure you do, Cravely.
Look, Gus.
Yeah, you're fucking Roger's fiance, and you know I know.
Yeah, I'm not even going to dignify that with a response.
Yeah, you're dignifying her in the ass at the Jefferson Hotel, room 1210. But let me ask you, the 3,000 agents Turner fired, was that because they lacked diplomatic skills as well?
You're referring to Admiral Stansfield Turner?
Yeah, the 3,000 agents, each and every goddamn one of them, first or second generation Americans, was that because they lacked the proper diplomatic skills? Or did Turner not think it was a good idea to have spies who could speak the same language as the people they're fucking spying on?
Well, I'm sorry, but you can hardly blame the director for questioning the loyalty to America of people that are just barely Americans in the first place.
Yeah, well, I'd like to take a moment to review the several ways in which you're a douchebag.
Get the fuck out of my office.
Yes, sir.
Before I end your career, asshole.
Yes, sir. Yeah, my friend, I'm gonna need you for a second.
God damn it!
My loyalty? For 24 years, people have been trying to kill me. People know how. Now, do you think that's because my dad was a Greek soda pop maker? Or do you think that's because I'm an American spy? Go fuck yourself, you fucking child. How was I?
You're watching the Zedalza Entertainment Network on ZenLive.tv.
Yes. Just amazing.
I love how he's... At the end, he let you know that he was in complete control.
Complete control. Hold on. That's
how was I?
How was I? What's going on? What's that? Hold on. Go ahead.
I sent you a text message. Think it's funny.
Hold on a second. Guys, the Skype is on. Zen Live TV. Please call in if you want to say anything about Rabbi Mark. Okay, first of all, all of our Tumblr people, I've got to get Ben on the phone from Based Heisenberg. We got to get Johnny Vroom on the phone. People from Tumblr. We got to talk about meme culture because I just started filling Anthony in on how deep the rabbit hole goes with memes and just all of this shit. I told Ben that he has to come on and just start from the beginning. Okay, I said, listen, we need to start from the beginning. And he goes, there's so much. Well, I said, we have to start from the beginning, especially because Anthony just got, we were talking about over the weekend, he just got exposed to all the Harambe stuff.
So the one you just showed me before the show, is that one that you found in your dank meme searches?
Oh, no, that's just something I stumbled upon. Oh,
okay. Yeah, it's hilarious. I don't know if we can get it up on the, hold on. Are you okay? Let me see if that gets.
No, not quite.
Now we'll put it on the screen for the 9 o'clock. We go live for the 9 o'clock show. We'll do like 15 to 20 minutes of some good stuff. We'll get good and lifted.
Oh yeah.
We'll get good and lifted, man. All right, so that was Rabbi Mark. Fantastic. Now let's get on to some other stuff here. Here's a Onion, an article from the Onion I thought was amazing. College professor reminds students it'll take a few classes to memorize everyone's triggers. Oh my God! It'd be funny if it wasn't so true.
Yeah.
Here's another thing. We'll save some other stuff. We'll save the rising tide of anti-globalization. G20 summit to deal with rising anti-globalization sentiments. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. The internet giveaway to the UN that supposedly strikes. We have to get to the bottom of that about ceding power of the internet to international powers now. And then, of course, we have scientists point telescope at strong signal from HD 164595. Which is a Earth. An Earth-like, nearby Earth-like planet,
wow.
A couple of light years away.
Wow.
Still take 90,000 years to get there.
In our fastest car.
Please, it's like, stop teasing us. Keep everything secret.
I know, right.
Until
I don't even
the day
know.
That we need to know.
I don't want to know that there are other people. We could be somewhere else right now. We could be having a better time right now.
Yeah, because the thing here is that I'm almost certain that we just have to except that we're in some in-between time,
right?
Where, you know...
Oh, wouldn't that be great? This was just an in-between time to the most awesome experience ever.
Yeah, like the next generation, like the generation that's about to be born.
Yeah. Oh, they're about to see some sick shit. They're about to see some sick shit. I'm a little jealous.
God, I hope they... You know, like I always look back at... I look back at the 70s. I look back at 70s style. I look back at... 70s television. I look back at 70s music, and it just seems just so boring to me. And brown, just brown and beige and orange and boring. And you know, as much as I'm sure it was a fun time for some people, I just don't want to go there. I don't want to go to the 70s. I hope that we don't become somebody's boring 70s.
I think we will. If we go far enough in the future, our lifestyle, because it's about lifestyle. I mean, the people in the 70s didn't say, oh, wow, the 70s is boring. They were fucking living their lives, you know? So I'm sure someone, I mean, they'll probably look at not only how we live, but obviously all the things that are happening around in the country, and they'll be like, fuck, why would I want to live in that stressful-ass time? You know?
You're right.
So.
You're right.
You're absolutely right.
What else can we do here before we get off the air? Tonight for Zadals in New York, I have a few things we could talk about aside from ourselves. Doctors wake coma patient by jump-starting his brain. We got to check that out. That was a non-invasive procedure, too. It's like they're putting, like, magnets around their head. It wasn't even like they're going into the brain and going, like, boop.
Jumper cables.
And then there's longest living human. He's 145 years old.
No.
Says he's ready for death. He's been waiting for death for years. He was born in 1870, dude. 1870, this guy was born.
Where's he from?
I believe he is in some Asian country. They were Asian.
Oh, my God.
Let me see here.
Poor man.
Indonesian man who claims to be the longest living human in recorded history has described how he just wants to die.
The hell?
People die at 75. It's usually, you know, he's 175.
Yeah. People, no, 145. Yeah.
Oh.
what did he say?
75 years old.
Muhammad Ali was 175.
You know what? 145 years old would have been.
Wait,
laughable.
Is it Muhammad Ali? Remember him coming to America? Muhammad Ali was
127 years old. Oh, no, he was 70. He was 74 years old. Yeah, wait, we got to watch that. That's what we'll do. That's much better than this.
Early Cuba Gooding Jr. in the barbiture.
Yep. You just said barbiture.
Barbiture.
Let me see here. Coming to America barbershop scene.
Oh, that scene is so funny.
What he says how old Joe Louis was.
Yeah, Joe.
That's the greatest.
Joe Louis's ass.
Oh, let me see here. And what we'll do is when we leave off, we're going to leave off with another clip from Charlie Wilson's War.
Yes.
The story of the Zen Master, which pretty much explains the beginning of what we talk about today, every day in
Everything.
Afghanistan and the Middle East. All of this shit that started right there, seriously.
It's the roots.
It's amazing.
It's the root of it all.
But you can just tell people like Gust didn't have control.
Did not.
Pound, sugar Ray Robinson, greatest anybody ever lived.
Oh, come on, man. What about Joe Louis?
The Brown Bomber. Now, that was a great boxer.
You damn right.
I suppose nobody in here ever heard of Cassius Clay.
We got a point. Cassius Clay was a bad motherfucker.
Hey, I ain't saying Clay ain't bad. I'm just saying I stopped liking Cassius Clay once you changed the name to Muhammad Ali. What kind of shit is that?
Wait a second. A man has the right to change his name to whatever he wants to change it to. And if a man wants to be called Muhammad Ali, God damn it, this is a free country. You should respect his wishes and call the man Muhammad Ali.
His mama named Clay. I'm going to call him Clay.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I say Clay.
Get out of here.
That's right. He can always be Clay to me. I don't give a fuck what you change name to. He is Clay. He Clay to me. I say Clay.
Well, then you're a putz. The three of you. Three putzes. You should change the name outside from Mighty Sharp to the Three Putzes.
You must be out of your goddamn mind. Joe Louis, the greatest boxer ever lived. I'll be with you boys in a minute. He was bad in Cassius Clay. He bad in Sugar Ray. He bad in that. Who that? The new boy had. Mike Tyson looked like a bulldog. He bad in him, too. He done whipped Mike Tyson's ass. He whipped all their asses.
What about Rocky Marciano?
Oh, there they go. There they go. Every time I start talking about boxing, a white man got to pull Rocky Marciano out their ass. That's the one. Rocky Marciano. Let me tell you something wonderful. Rocky Marciano was good. But compared to Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano ain't shit.
He beat Joe Louis's ass.
That's right. He did whoop Joe Louis' ass. Joe Louis was 75 years old when he fought.
I don't know how old he was, but he got an ass whooped.
Joe Louis had come out of retirement to fight Rocky Marciano. The man was 76 years old. Joe Louis always lied about his age. He lied about his age all the time. One time, Frank Sinatra comes out here and sat down in this chair. And I said, Frank, you hang out with Joe Louis. Just between me and you, how old is Joe Louis? You know what Frank told me? He said, hey, Joe Louis 137 years old. 137 years old.
Oh, man, you ain't never meet no Frank Sinatra.
You're watching the Zidaza Entertainment Network on ZenLive.tv.
Oh, my God.
And fuck you, too. Eddie fucking Murphy, man.
My God.
The new guy, the new kid.
The new guy, Mike Tyson.
Oh, just showing you how old that movie is.
Jesus. All right, guys. Well, listen, this was a great addition. We'll get a little bit into, we'll lead with David Seaman tomorrow because we had a pretty good run.
We did
touch on David Seaman. Actually, that was one of the best 10 minutes of talk I've had on this show in many months. That was great. Got to get into there. But in either case, thank you guys so much for hanging out. We're going to do some Facebook stream testing over here for the next hour because Broken Filter Live is not on tonight. Joe Rockstar is on vacation, a well-deserved vacation.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to do some Facebook Live testing. At 9 o'clock, we will be live for Zidaza New York. But in the meantime, we're going to do this. Also, if you guys enjoyed yourself, if you're a newcomer, if you're an oldcomer, whatever the hell it is, if you like what goes on over here every night and you want to help keeping it going, I would love to have your support if you check out patreon.com/ quite frankly. And there's all types of thank you packages for being a supporter of the show, even if it's just $1 a month. And speaking of that, I got to say my thank yous to all the people that I work for right now. That's exactly what it is. Where the hell are we? Patreon. Nope, that's not it. You guys just relax because I need to say thank you. Was this it? Ah. Nope, that's not it either. How many fucking emails do I have from Patreon here? I took a screenshot of all the patrons because they all, you know, $1 means a shout out. So at least everybody did a shout out worth. God damn it. Hold on a second, guys. Oh, wait. Nope. I want to thank Max. Max was the last one to pledge. He pledged $1 last night. So Max and Caparato, you're the man. Nikki, Moonlit Matt, Mintz, Andrew Dame, let me see who else, Laura Veris. I got to get everybody out. And if I miss your name tonight, I'm going to say your name three times tomorrow like it's, you know, Bloody Mary in the mirror at the bathroom at midnight with the lights off. You show up. We have a face-to-face. We talk about our days. And, you know, we go our separate way afterwards. You go back into the mirror. I go back to the other side of my reality on the other side of the mirror. I go to bed. You go to bed. Maybe I play PlayStation for a little bit until about 1 a.m. if I've already showered. If I haven't showered, I get into the shower. And when I'm in the shower, I just, you know, I first sync up my podcast thing, all my podcasts with the Bluetooth device in the shower, and I listen to podcasts. You know, sometimes it's Welcome to Night Vale or something like that, something spooky sounding. Other times, if I need a laugh, it's Alex Jones. Other times, it's Michael Savage. Sometimes it's, you know, a couple other podcasts I've been listening to. But that's it. That's how our nights go. So I'll meet you at midnight in front of your bathroom mirror. Say, quite frankly, three times, and I will show up. I will show up. Trust me. See you guys soon. Be well. Oh, what's going on, Scotty? I see you in there. No, that's it. Goodbye.